Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Grand Illusions, American Art and the First World War, takes readers on a compelling journey through the major historical events leading up to and beyond U.S. involvement in World War I to discover the vast and pervasive influence of the conflict on American visual culture. In this lecture, held on December 10, 2017, at the National Gallery of Art, David M. Lubin presents an examination of the era's fine arts and entertainment to show how they ranged from patriotic idealism to profound disillusionment. Grand Illusions assesses the war's impact on 24 painters, designers, photographers, and filmmakers from 1914 to 1933. Lubin considers well-known figures such as Marcel Duchamp, John Singer Sargent, D.W. Griffith, and the self-trained African-American artist Horace Pippin, while resurrecting forgotten artists such as the mask maker Anna Coleman Ladd, the sculptor Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney, and the combat artist Claggett Wilson. Armed with rich cultural historical details and an interdisciplinary narrative approach, Lubin creatively upends traditional understandings of the Great War's effect on the visual arts in America.
About 10 years ago, I started thinking about the First World War, and there was a common assumption. I thought, I'd like to write about World War I. As it happens, I only realized later that a lot of my scholarship has been about death and trauma and sort of bad crises happening. And here I'm doing it again with World War I. I mean, so what kind of sick mind do I have? I'm not sure, but I thought, why is it that people think, that our historians think, that World War I had such a huge impact on European art? I mean, that's undeniable. Everybody understands that. But historians of American art think that it had no effect or a negligible effect on what was happening over here. And so it's not so much scholarly work isn't that you have this idea that you have to ram home. It's more you get curious about something and sort of, why is this a lacuna? Why is it, you know, so misunderstood or not understood or neglected? And so I just wanted to examine those kinds of issues. Well, you look at this chart here, and you see that this is combatants killed in the war. I'm not talking about wounded, not talking about casualties, but actual killed in the World War I. Germany lost 1.77 million soldiers. Russia, virtually the same. France, 1.3 million. Austria-Hungary, 1.2 million. The British just were under the line at 900,000. Italy, which entered the war late, lost 650,000. America lost 117,000. So you can see right away, people think, well, America was only in the war for 18 months. And for those first 12 months, it was about training the troops, getting the troops over to France. And so it was really about 6 or maybe 7 months of combat. And of those 117,000 deaths, more than half of them died not from bullets, but from microbes. The influenza wiped out huge numbers of our men. So really, combat deaths for Americans in the First World War were, I think, 50, 55,000 men, which again is probably as many as we lost in the Vietnam War. But it's a, and in the Civil War, we lost 600,000 men, over 600,000. So you could see why people thought, well, this war couldn't have had a big effect on it, on American art. Well, finally, last year, I published a book, Grand Illusions, Oxford University Press. I have to compliment the designer, who I never met, but because I'm talking about how illusions melted away during the war, I love the sort of graphic of that. The painting itself shows people blindfolded, which is this great painting by John Singer Sargent, which I'll discuss later. But so they are blinded. So I was really thinking about that motif of blindness, illusion, how we get motivated to do things that aren't necessarily in our best interest, or to vote for policies or politicians who aren't necessarily doing us a favor. So that's more or less what I was working on. And I kept thinking as I was going through this material, and basic goal of my book, or the project I set for myself, was to look at lots of different artists from different levels, fine artists, illustrators, commercial artists, photographers, filmmakers, sculptors. I even got into plastic surgeons because they're also changing the look of things. I wanted to know, how did all these things, how were these people reacting to the war? For the war began over 2 years before America got in the war, but it was already having an effect on changing consciousness. And the war, I came to argue, had a lot of effect afterward. It wasn't suddenly the war was over and people stopped thinking about it. It had a real lingering effect on the way. It still has an effect on the way we see our world and how we line things up. First World War was crucial to the geopolitics of today, as well as sort of the emotional, and I will argue, the body values, the body appearance values we have today. So those are the kind, that's the spectrum of material I was trying to analyze in Grand Illusions, and it seemed to me one of the illusions that needs to be dissolved, perhaps, is this one I've been talking about, that the World War I had no effect on American art. So around the time I was looking at all this, I started thinking, this would be a killer art exhibition. So I talked to Frank and other friends of mine in the museum world, and then I, with two co-curators, we sort of hadn't known each other before, but a man named Bob Cozzolino and a woman named Ann Knutson got together, and we put together this show, or a list of artwork that we wanted to talk about, because the three of us had come separately to the same set of interests. Well, we spent several years trying to get somebody to accept the show. But they wouldn't accept the show because they kept saying, how can you make a show about American art when there was no American art during the First World War? And we said, stupid, that's the whole point. That's what we want to show in our show, is that there was some American art being formulated then. Anyway, finally we did get some wonderful backers, and the show opened the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts a year ago, the New York Historical Society this summer, and now it's completing its run at the Frist Center for the Visual Arts in Nashville. So I want to start off, basically my book and also our show starts off with this image. Have any of you ever seen this image before? Okay, not many have. Just a few of you raise your hands. What we see is, in a sort of greenish-gray background, we see a young woman, bubbles coming out of her lips, holding a baby in her arms, clasping it tightly, and she's sinking to the bottom of the ocean. And there's a fish going by looking at her like, who is this? And there's only one word in the poster, bold outlined letter in list. Now this painting came out in June, it was a painting first, made into a poster, in June of 1915, a couple weeks after the sinking of the Lusitania. So the first thing I want to say is that everybody who saw this poster, every American who saw this poster 2 weeks after the sinking, 3 weeks after the sinking, knew there was a reference to the Lusitania. You didn't need more information than that. And these are some headlines I pulled from various newspapers. When the catastrophe struck, nobody really knew how many had died. So one newspaper says 1,000 probably are lost. There are other numbers I can't read from here. 1,400 lives. Well, it turned out 1,200 lives were lost, and of those 1,200 lives, 128 were U.S. citizens. So really a small number, a small percentage, but it inflamed American fury the way Pearl Harbor did or 9/11. Those maybe are obviously bigger events, but it had that same sort of effect of getting people really outraged. And so one of the stories that kept getting repeated about the sinking of the Lusitania was that when the bodies washed up on shore on the coast of Ireland, there was found the body of a young mother clasping to her bosom her infant child. And that story made the rounds. And so everybody, I'm saying, would have understood that's what's being referenced here. So first of all, I'd say the artist, whose name is Fred Speer, that we know nothing about, I've worked and worked, can't find anything about the artist Fred Speer, But Fred Speer signed this, and I would say that Fred Speer had to have been aware of paintings like this. A 19th century Pre-Raphaelite painting, Ophelia, in the Tate Museum now, of Shakespeare's heroine sinking to the bottom of a muddy river, in that case, a suicidal posture. Or this painting, which is in Washington at SAM, showing an angel clasped with hands over the knee. I mean, that seems to me, I'm not saying that Fred Speer specifically was referring to this painting, but it was an image of virginal, pure Victorian womanhood that the poster is talking about here, because that was the main way, at least at the beginning, that people who wanted America to go to war with Germany, they said that over and over again, that our women are being defiled, and if we don't watch out, this will be a terrible thing. And had this occurs to me that had this woman been marked as an Irish-American immigrant, had she been African-American, had she been clearly a laboring woman, I don't think it would have gotten the same general outrage that associating her with these fair-skinned Madonnas and virgins would have. Okay, go backward. I'm going to go backward for a second. Now, here's a key point I want to make about this. Only one word. That's what really strikes me as so powerful about this image, is only one word. And I would say it's the birth of modern advertising. Now, I'm being hyperbolic there. There are other things that were going on. But if you look at advertisements from earlier periods, even this picture from a few years earlier, it's verbose. Advertisement used to, the ads thought that they could sell things to you by talking you into it, over-talking you. And so the imagery would be very minimal. So this is, I love this. This is for Dr. Scott's electric corsets. And I've really been wondering what an electric corset is. And like, do you plug it in behind you and sort of walk around, but you can never get very far because you're tethered? But anyway, you see the point I'm making there, that advertisers, many of whom, the founders of the modern advertising industry in America and modern public relations industry, started off by being young soldiers in the propaganda industry, the Ministry for Information. I forget what the Creel Report it was called, the Committee for Public Information is what it was called. And they realized in a nation of immigrants with many people who don't speak English as their first language, who can't read English even, you don't want to have a lot of word because they wouldn't be able to understand. They wouldn't be able to follow it. And these had to be seen from moving very fast, like in a streetcar hurtling down the road at 15 miles an hour. That was so fast that they didn't have time to read text. They just had to have one strong, instantly recognizable image and a minimum of verbiage. So that's what it seems to me, the war, again, I would say this was going to happen anyway, but there's this crossover between the military need, the commercial, new commercial innovation, and people's psychological needs. They all sort of come together in these war posters. Now, by the way, I don't have a clock, so I'm going to be talking to you probably for about 2 or 3 hours. Unless somebody wildly, my wife, wherever she is, waves her hand and does like that. My book, early on I talk about somebody named Marsden Hartley, and then later I talk about Child Hassam. For our exhibition, after we showed Enlist and a beautiful animated film that was made of the sinking of Lusitania at the same time, we put together two very important American artists, Child Hassam, that's how he pronounced the name, not Hassam, because he was definitely not Middle Eastern. He prided himself in his New England background. So Child Hassam was a patriot, and he had studied in France. He had studied with the Impressionists. He was America's leading Impressionist artist and a great artist. And when the war began in Europe, he was outraged at the thought of his beloved France being invaded by the Germans. And he wanted America to join the war effort, to join the Allied sides. So to that end, He's not a propagandist, but he's a great impressionist painter. And like his, this is the painting in the National Gallery, the one on the left. He modeled himself on Claude Monet, the master of this serial painting, of showing haystacks, cathedral fronts, water lilies, always again and again the same motif. So Child Hassam painted approximately 30, 33 paintings of flags flying over New York. Sometimes they were solely American flags, and sometimes they were the flags of the Allied nations. So the modern metropolis is festooned with the flags. There's a sense here, for Hassam, that modernity and good civilization is tied, you know, hand in glove with patriotism and the flag. You can't have one without the other, he would have said, or he would have thought. Whereas to him and to many Americans, the Germans represented the forces of barbarism. They were the barbarians at the gate who were threatening the peaceful development of civilization that Hassam portrayed. Well, Marsden Hartley was America's first abstract artist. And he was a great artist who was born in Lewiston, Maine. He came from a very difficult childhood. He moved to Cleveland and then eventually New York. And he was an outsider in every way. And he had a hard time making friends. You know, we later realized he was gay and that was part of the problem he was encountering. But he had a great champion, somebody who really looked after him, was America's most important impresario of modern art, Alfred Stieglitz, who later married George O'Keefe, and Stieglitz in his own right was an important artist as a photographer. So Stieglitz said to Hartley, you can't really be the artist that I think you can be unless you go over to France and train. You have to be part of the scene in Paris. So Stieglitz sends him over to Paris with a letter of introduction to Gertrude Stein. And he becomes part of the Stein Salon in Paris. And like Picasso would come by and Braque would come by, Matisse. And Hartley writes these sort of angry letters towards Stieglitz because he recognized what great artists they were. They didn't pay him the time of day. Well, while he was there, he met a young German cavalry officer named Karl von Freiberg, and Hartley fell in love with this officer. We don't have any idea, I have no idea whether the officer reciprocated, but Hartley moved to Berlin to be closer to this officer. And Berlin, as it happens, was by far the most gay-tolerant city in the world. And there was much more tolerance for homosexuality there than certainly anywhere in America. So he becomes an expatriate artist and paints these, I'll talk about some of his art later, but he paints these beautifully abstract or semi-abstract paintings. Then Germany goes to war. And in his letters to Stieglitz, he's just saying, this is terrible, this is horrible, the thought of our young manhood on either side going off to war. Von Freiberg goes off to war as cavalry officer and dies very early on in the Battle of the Marne. Hartley is devastated. He's heartbroken. This to him is like the greatest tragedy he can imagine. And he starts painting a series of black, mournful, symbolic portraits of von Freiberg. The one I was looking at before is another one of these. It just calls it a portrait. And the numbers and insignias and flags, these are all symbols of the man that he loved and lost. Because, I would contend, in part because of his homosexuality, he could not announce publicly his mourning of this person. But he symbolically does these amazing elegy paintings of these images, these semi-abstract images, these flags on this black background. So I just want you to look at this briefly, class. I'll quiz you about this on the midterm. Notice how vibrant and joyous with the blue sky, the white clouds, and how, in a sense, lugubrious this is. The masterpiece of the series is Portrait of a German Officer, which We wanted very much to be in our show, but the realities of museum politics are that the Met wouldn't lend it to us. So you have to go to New York if you want to see this in person. You see the initials KVF, Carl von Freiburg. So right off, and I'll leave these two for now, but again, the point I want to make is there's no single reaction to the war. And this is something that always bothers me personally. When people say, oh, men are like that, women are like that, Jews are like that, black people are like that, Democrats are like that, Republicans are like that. We live in a culture where we sort of have a tendency to lump everyone together, paint everybody with the same broad brush. And I think just by comparing these two artists, we see two very different tracks they had in terms of reaction to the war and what art should do. Well, if you have a war that's 3,000 miles away and your homeland has not been invaded, as was the case with Pearl Harbor, let's say, how do you sell a war to people? How do you get people to risk their lives? How do you get young men to hurl themselves against machine guns and barbed wire? Not only that, how do you get their fiancés to let them go? How do you get their mothers to let them go? There had to be a real campaign to persuade people that Americans needed to go fight abroad, as I say, because there was no attack on American shores. The closest you come to it is the Lusitania of the 128 deaths. Well, one of the greatest sort of advertising brains in America was a man named George Creel, and President Wilson headed him up to be head of the, let's call it what it is, the propaganda industry. And posters, Creel, where's my friend Jim? Howard Chandler Christie was appointed to be the head of the propaganda painting. Christie would go out and get all these artists he knew. He was like one of the two or three most famous illustrators of the time. And he recruited a lot of his colleagues to paint brilliant images. And it was one of the high points of American graphic arts, the posters that resulted. And you can see from this one image that one of my colleagues stumbled upon, here's a middle school classroom. I don't even know what city it's in. But you see how all these posters, there's Uncle Sam up there, all these posters are put in front of us in a kind of constant visual assault or visual persuasion. Not just one image, but they were a mass of images. We talked today about how we live in a media society where we're just so awash in images. And we talk about our teenagers, our young people today with social media, how imagery with Instagram, et cetera, is inescapable. But this shows that back in 1917, imagery was also inescapable. They didn't have television sets, but every bank, post office, hospital, recruitment center, schoolyard, they were just covered with these wonderful posters. So this is the single most famous image to come out of World War I from any land. I think this is the most often seen, most often reproduced, most parodied image of all time. And, you know, it's so easy to say, I want you, except for U.S. Army. I know Wake Forest will be, I want you for my keg party. So it lends itself to all kinds of usages. What a lot of people don't, well, what you see here is a very stern Uncle Sam pointing his finger with wonderful foreshortening at the viewer, saying, I want you for U.S. Army. And he's decked out in blue and red, white, and blue, and a hat spangled with stars on it. The figure of Uncle Sam was Flagg himself, who was a vain man. He loved his looks and he loved to portray himself. And so here he puts on some false whiskers and extends his hair a little bit. And so, and he was a real ladies' man. So I think it was also in part sort of like, hey, babe, I want you. A little bit of element of that. But what most of us don't realize is that he's doing a parody of an earlier image by the British that was very well known. That's Lord Kitchener, the head of the German military. Britain's Lord Kitchener wants you, and he also is pointing the finger, not giving the finger, but pointing it. And what I contend is that Flagg is showing his Americanness. He's flattering the viewer, because Americans, particularly if you look back then, love to flatter themselves, ourselves, on our great sense of humor, our frontier humor, our sense of tongue-in-cheekness, whereas we are stereotyped, going back to stereotypes. The stereotype is the British is that they're very dry and humorless and filled with themselves. And so I would say that this picture, whoops, is a response to that, a sort of the most popular form of entertainment in 1917 when this came out was vaudeville. And he really makes Uncle Sam into a vaudevillian, a vaudeville comedian. At least that's my contention. One of the other most stunning pictures from this, I'm going to look at my, I do have a, okay, from the war is this poster, Enlist, on which side of the window are you? And it shows a man in black in an interior, and outside is a resplendent American flag. And doughboys, handsome doughboys, marching in formation off to war. And this man is inside, and he's gnarled with self-doubt and thinking, you know, what am I doing here? Why aren't I part of this event, or should I be? And if you see the real poster, you can't see in this slide, but you even see a little bit of gleams on his wingtips down below. So it's a very sensitively done image. Well, my colleague Ann Knutson, during her dissertation research on this poster, among others, was very curious who Laura Bray is. It's signed Laura Bray. Turns out Laura Bray was maybe 21-year-old art student at the Art Institute of Chicago School. And there was a contest for who could design the best recruitment poster. This was her entry, and it won. And then we've never heard from Laura Bray again. I think it's a brilliant piece of work. And one of the things that strikes me, this was 1917. In 1916, America's greatest realist artist, Thomas Eakins, had died. And the Metropolitan Museum of Art had a memorial tribute show to Eakins. And this was the centerpiece of it, a painting that's now known as The Thinker. It's a portrait of his brother-in-law. And the man is very sad-looking, and he's weighted down. You almost feel his suit is rumpled with the gravity of his thoughts. I don't know if you buy it or not, but it seems to me entirely possible that Laura Bray sees, when she depicts this man, she's thinking of something like this. He's younger, he's handsomer, but it's that kind of feeling. Well, this too is, her brilliant picture is also appealing to a British earlier source, Daddy, What Did You Do in the Great War? Which is imagining a British man at home and in the armchair with his daughter and his son. The son's playing with toy soldiers, and the daughter, who seems to be pointing to some book, maybe it's a history of the war book, is saying, Daddy, what did you do in the Great War? And obviously, he's remorseful with shame that he hadn't been a participant. So what both posters are doing, I contend, is they're playing on male anxiety, a male need to prove himself as a heroic figure, somebody that his children can look up to, not an effete person like this. And I also think there might be some, on which side of the window are you? When I look at this, I always think, on which side of the closet door are you? Are you a real man? Are you a, to use a term that was invented back then, are you a sissy? So, again, posters like this help give birth to advertising. Now, this is a very long text-written advertisement from early 1920s for Listerine. How's your breath today? But you see, it's the same idea. The basic concept of advertising is make the person who's looking at your image feel insecure about their own personal boundaries, their own personal skills. You know, this is, if it's, how's your breath today? If it's bad, you won't be welcome. I mean, it's about fear of being ostracized. And that's exactly what this poster is. If you don't join the war effort, you don't throw your heart into it, you will be kept out of the good things. Okay, this poster has now become a very famous poster called Destroy This Mad Brute, Enlist. And what you see is a hairy gorilla drooling from the mouth, his fangs open. There, almost counterparting his fangs, are the ruins of Belgium, probably the cathedral, the cloth wool hall at Cloth Market at Ypres. And he's got a torch, a flaming, or former torch, a blood-splattered club that says Kultur, which was the Germans took great pride in their great civilization of Goethe and Schubert, and, well, he's Austrian, but Bach, Beethoven, you know, the Germanic culture. They thought that their Kultur was going to enlighten the world. And the Americans thought, no, it's just the opposite. They're destroying civilization. And he's carrying a naked woman, half-naked woman in his arms. Her hair is kind of falling down. He's obviously raped her or is about to rape her. And the idea is, if you don't stop the war over there, that's what's going to happen over here. Now, the woman could be seen as an allegorical figure for Lady Liberty, and that's who's being ravaged and potentially raped and violated. But I want to show you right now that I'm a mind reader, because I think I know what image you're thinking of. And it's this. Whoops, no, sorry, it's not that. This is just a detail showing the mad ape wearing a German spiked helmet and what was called a Kaiser Wilhelm mustache. So he's clearly identified. But now's the mind reading part where, you know, now is that an accidental? King Kong was made 15 years after this poster was initiated. But the director, screenwriter, the camera man of King Kong, they were all had fought in the war. They knew what was going on, and I think they very directly are appropriating this image. Well, this image then has an even further afterlife. In 1940, 41, hasn't been exactly dated, Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister for Hitler, took this poster, and what we talk about today, how artists appropriate previous art, Goebbels has the original poster appropriated and basically says, 25 years ago, they likened us to brutes, beasts. This is their rotten, slanderous lies, what they think about the German people. So Goebbels is trying to instill anger against the Americans. By the way, Hitler in Mein Kampf, which he wrote in the mid-20s, said, we would have won the war, I mean the Germans, had we had the sophistication of the British and American propaganda industry. They really knew how to create fake news, he didn't use that term, but to play people, basically. And so when he started working with Goebbels, the idea was let's catch up with what the Americans had done. Now this image, has anybody ever seen this image before? In 2008, Annie Leibovitz, the very, very famous celebrity photographer, was commissioned to do a cover for Vogue magazine. So she got LeBron James and Gisele Bündchen to mimic this poster. Now, I know I've talked to students, and they thought, before they know about this poster, they think it has to do with King Kong. But it really has to do, as you can tell from the color of the dress, the growl on his face, instead of a club that says culture, has a basketball. Now, this was meant, I would say, as a humorous image. It was meant parodically. However, many readers condemned it as being racist. And I would say it is a racist image. It's playing up images of black male bestiality and white female innocence. So Vogue was disciplined by that. They didn't like having all these readers condemn them for this, writing in letters. So when I was publishing my book, of course I wanted this image to be in my book to illustrate this section where I'm talking about. But Condé Nast absolutely, adamantly refused to allow me the rights to have this. So that even, to me, proves my point even more. There was an anti-war movement. I'm going to have to stop soon. I've hardly started. The anti-war movement was in left-wing magazines, like the famous socialist magazine, The Masses, and they would have cartoons like this one, Fattened by the Horrors of War. There's Uncle Sam, and the workers are being paid slave labor wages so that the industrialists can be fattened. And this became a very famous cartoon. Army medical examiner, who's clasping his hands together in glee, at last a perfect soldier, meaning one who has all brawn and no brains. And this poster actually makes me think of this, from different sides of things. Well, this magazine, the masses, kept putting out posters like this, but once America went to war, about 6 weeks later, Congress legislated that it was absolutely illegal to write, draw, or say anything that could be construed as anti-war. That was the most severe period of censorship in American history. It just absolutely shut down on any freedom of expression. People who did say that the war was about, you know, the rich getting richer, those people were sent to jail. Anybody who criticized Wilson or others risked jail time. This picture in particular, showing a skeleton measuring a naked recruit for his coffin, was considered so outrageously anti-military, so much an impediment, to the war effort, that the magazine was essentially shut down and the artist had to flee to Mexico to avoid a jail term. One more poster that I'll show you. America's finest engraver, best known etching artist, graphic artist who had studied with Whistler. There's Ellen Todd. Hi, Ellen. Martin, hi. He did this poster of the Statue of Liberty, whose head has been knocked off. The Statue of Liberty has been decapitated. A German U-boat is in New York Harbor. German airplanes are flying over Manhattan, bombing it with incendiary bombs. And the original title said, "Buy Liberty Bonds or we'll see this happen over here." Well, we didn't see it happen over here until, 70, 75 years later with the 9/11 attacks. But this was a very potent image to stir Americans up. Well, I've shown you all these sad images. I'm going to show you an image that I love. Just a beautiful image by an artist very little known today named Gifford Beale. And it's called On the Hudson at Newburgh, 1918. It's in our exhibition. It's a new... Are you coming to tell me my time is up? Is my rent due? this is just a pristine image showing a mother in a mountainous part of the country with a beautiful river, soldiers marching off to war. There's a steamship in the distance, and there is a young mother holding an infant in one arm and sort of holding by the hand her little daughter in a sailor suit on the other hand. And the mom has this very pleasing S-curve, and it's just radiant, the use of the shades of blues, the browns. I think this is an exquisite painting. This painting was only discovered 10 years ago, let's say. I'm not sure the exact date. It was discovered here in Washington at the Phillips Gallery. And what happened is some conservators were going through the collection, looking at paintings that had never been exhibited, not been exhibited in years. And there was a picture of two circus elephants with a circus performer riding on one of them. And they noticed something strange about the dimensions of the painting, and they realized there was another painting underneath it. So they carefully peeled away the painting on top, and this is what they discovered underneath it. And the artist, Gifford Beale, was somebody who, is his name Duncan Phillips, the Phillips Gallery? Yeah, it's Duncan, isn't it? He had really liked Gifford Beale, and Beale sold him a lot of his work. But at the end of the war, Americans wanted to forget the war. They weren't interested in it anymore. And Beale couldn't sell this to his patron, to Phillips, or anybody else. So rather than just toss the canvas, which he'd already stretched, he just put a new canvas on it and painted the circus elephants. And that's what Phillips bought. That's what he thought he was getting. Anyway, so I'm happy to see this painting see light of day again. I do want to leave some time for questions. In our show, we talked about how abstract artists were influenced by the war. This is the use of the Dazzle ship. It was a camouflage ship that simultaneously American and British modern artists were developing. But here's a painting by John Marin, a watercolor by Marin, that has always been seen as a pure abstraction. And he gives it a purely abstract title, Movement B. And you just see these yellow forms, green forms, red forms. But my colleague, Anne, who was particularly working on this subject, came upon this newspaper image of a German gun installation outside Verdun. And the newspaper points out that every time you see a circle, it's where there's an artillery encampment, an embankment, and the road is a service road around it. And then we look at Marin's picture, and it's not to say, oh, Marin's picture, you thought it was an abstraction, it's really, you know, just imitating this newspaper photo. We're not saying that, but we're saying that there's not such a clear-cut line between high art and popular art and journalism and photography. These things are all part of the sustained visual culture. She also talks about this abstract painting by Georgia O'Keeffe, again given an abstract name, number 20 special, 1916-17, but compares it to the kinds of photos that were so prevalent in the papers of men moving through trenches. Charles Birchfield, who was known for his sort of tormented, writhing Ohio marshlands and forests, you could sort of see that he paints this during the war. And Birchfield was terrified that he was going to be called up into the army. And he talks about the nightmares he had about that, the nightmares he had about going to war. And you look at this tree with these teeth and jagged edges and pendulous, perhaps, breasts. People interpret this differently. But there's some sort of agony going on here. Yeah, he you know, this might have been part of the way an artist works. Things enter consciousness, they enter unconsciousness. And when you choose your motifs, you don't necessarily know why you're doing or where it's coming from, how it's been sourced. That's what our historians try to do after the fact. The great British artist Paul Nash was making paintings at the same time of the battlefields in France and Belgium and gives them ironic titles like We Are Making a New World. The new world is not the happy, new, radiant world, but rather this very horrible, ravaged new world. Well, I have a whole chapter in my book on Marcel Duchamp. I'm not going to go into it now since I only have like 3 minutes. But Duchamp, I would say the most important, this has been voted, the work of the 20th century that has been the most single most influential work of modern art is not by Warhol or Picasso or Matisse. It's Duchamp, and particularly this work, Fountain, which was reproduced in replica editions in the 60s. There's Duchamp sitting by it. And Duchamp, of course, with this said, anything that an artist signs as art should be considered art. It's the artist's prerogative to decide what is art and what's not art. And so he's going against centuries of artistic traditions. He's, you know, thumbing his nose at that. Well, what people don't realize is that famously this work was rejected by the Society of Independent Artists, an exhibition that opened on April 10th, 1917. And the exhibition, their claim was, we are not going to judge any art. Anybody who pays the $5 entrance fee can exhibit his or her work in the show. We are not going to make judgments. So Duchamp, who was actually a member of the committee, I mean, he was on the board of this organization, secretly submitted a store-bought murinal, which he signed with a pseudonym, Armut, 1917. He submitted it, and they rejected it. And to him, that was a proof of their hypocrisy, that they said they would take anything. And he's saying, no, there are boundary lines of what people will consider art or not art. Well, what I want to point out was that Duchamp submitted this 3 days after America declared war on Germany. And he was very offended by Americans going to war. He had fled France in 1915, and he said he was disgusted with the Germans and the French. He said, I hate militarism of all kind. I'm not a nationalist. I don't have sort of these national passions. I believe we should be cosmopolitan. And so it seems to me the poster is, it's not just randomly that he picks a toilet, a urinal. There's a lot of deeper meaning to it, including, you know, piss on war, piss on this whole thing. It's like in Shakespeare, pox on both your houses. So it was rejected noisily. People were in a furor about this thing, and they rejected it. And Alfred Stieglitz, who was no friend to Duchamp's, but recognized this is a moment of huge historical importance, he asked Duchamp's permission to photograph the urinal. So they took it up to 291, which was Stieglitz's famous art gallery, where, I didn't explain this earlier, but when Marsden Hartley finally had to leave Berlin, he came back to New York, and Stieglitz had a one-man exhibition for him. None of the works sold. People didn't understand them, and they didn't appreciate the fact that it seemed to be pro-German. So Stieglitz bought one of the paintings for himself, the one he considered the best in the series, and that's the one I showed you earlier, Portrait of a German Officer. So when Stieglitz takes this up to the Gallery 291, he's giving a show to a new artist, his latest discovery, a young artist named Georgia O'Keeffe. So that was the beginning of O'Keeffe's career, exactly when this is happening. And what Stieglitz could have done is photographed Fountain in front of a blank wall, white wall, the white, sort of white cube look that we're all so familiar with now, or he could have hung it in front of an O'Keeffe painting. Instead, he chooses, oh, there's Portrait of a German Officer. He chooses to put it in front of a Hartley painting celebrating German cavalry officers marching in parade. And so what he does there, it's hard to tell because it's sort of blurred out of focus, but I don't know if you can see right here, there's a profile of a man with a little stripe running down his arm. That's that man right there. And so what Stieglitz has done is he takes the urinal, which actually, this Hartley painting was from a few years earlier, he takes that basic shape and he superimposes Fountain on front of it, in front of it. So I consider this a three-way collaboration. Duchamp, Hartley, and Stieglitz, three brilliant artists, their work being conflated in one. And I should say, Fountain no longer exists. It disappeared. There are all sort of legends about what's happened to it. One of my friends says we should check out all the old office buildings in Manhattan. Maybe it's been, you know, there on the urinal wall. But basically, Duchamp, they probably just discarded it. They probably didn't care. So the only actual record we have of this groundbreaking, history-changing work is the Stieglitz photo of it set up in front of the Hartley painting about war. I know I've got to end soon. So, God, we haven't even talked about John Singer Sargent or The Greatest Discovery. I'm going to talk a little bit longer. Thank you. You're a good class. So this is one of the things. Research is so fun. If any of you are actually thinking of becoming a professor or have kids who are choosing between making millions as an investment broker or being in poverty as a scholar, this is for the scholarly pleasure. I discovered in doing my research that when Duchamp did this, he was in a building on West 67th Street. And somebody, his patron, had loaned him a studio. And it was in an artist studio building. And in that same building, at the same time, was created what I've already told you, I think, is the most famous image to come out of World War I. Both of these images were from, I think it's 33 West 67th Street in Manhattan at the same time. So I love to think about Duchamp going down, meeting James Montgomery Flagg at the mailboxes and having some sort of banter. And I also like the fun. This means nothing, but I even see the Duchamp as a kind of abstract Uncle Sam pointing his valve at us. All right, well, at least one other thing I'll say, and I might say more, but I mean, I'm so used to teaching where there's a clock there, and my students are very good about slamming their desks shut to let me know that it's time, but I don't see you, I don't have desktops here, so I can go. Okay, this I do have to tell you about this. One of the colleagues I was getting to work on the show with emailed me one day, and she said, David, I was going through the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the SAM Archives, or Archives of American Art. No, it was the SAM Archives. And I keep seeing references to this person named Claggett Wilson. She was just putting in keywords like World War I, Doughboys, Armistice. And this Claggett Wilson's name kept appearing. So she said, one of us needs to check it out. Well, I was coming up to Washington on another business, so I made an appointment at SAM. I said, I would like to see these images, 24 images by Claggett Wilson. They said, who? Claggett who? Nobody had any idea. They were in deep storage, but they very kindly, very generously set aside a morning for me, pulled all these images. I was blown away. I thought, these are amazing images. I couldn't wait to get Bob and Ann to come to Washington to see them with me. And so we knew at that point, we have to get Claggett Wilson in our show. I, meanwhile, was doing a lot of research on Claggett Wilson, so I became sort of the lead person, the expert on Wilson. Well, what happened is, he was a soldier, he was an art instructor at Columbia University. He had actually trained at a modern art academy in Paris. He showed a work in the famous Armory Show of 1913. He had a lowly job at Columbia teaching art. When America entered the war, he patriotically volunteered, and he joined the Marines. And so he spends his first, you know, 6-8 months training, and then they send him to France, and he writes his chair of his department back home, you know, I hope I see some action, because every great artist has to see something really profound. So he's already thinking about what this is all about. So he ends up fighting in the bloodiest battle, the sort of legendary Battle of Belleau Wood at Chateau Thierry, a huge loss of life for the Marines. And after the, and he's wounded. He's mustard gassed. He has to be sent to hospital. When he comes back, he's immediately sent to the front again. He wins medals for his valor. And when the war is over, he's assigned to the army of the German occupation. It's the occupying the Rhine right after the war to protect, you know, keep the peace. And Wilson gets hold of some watercolor paper and some watercolors, and he does, within a couple months, these amazing paintings on water, you know, on paper. He sends them home. He's demobilized in April, so he gets on the ship back to New York. He puts his paintings in the hold. They're never seen again. Complete loss. And, you know, many of us would have just, like, given it up right there if you're an artist and you did this brilliant work. But he, instead, there's a family house in Maine where he could be alone. He went up to Maine. In about a month, in a white heat, he recreated all the paintings he had lost. And the paintings, I contend, are about his sort of hallucinations of the war, what he had experienced or what he had heard about his friends experiencing. So, oddly, the paintings that we have now that have been in storage in SAM for all these years, from basically 1920 or 25 to 19 to now, these are memories of the earlier paintings. So they're memories of memories, which are in themselves memories of nightmares and things he had seen. Now, with that buildup, I'll show you. We put this on the cover of our book. He would give these descriptive titles on the back of the paintings. The bursting of a heavy shell, not as it looks, but as it feels and sounds and smells. And I have a colleague, when I was in Nashville for the opening of the show, I had a colleague from Vanderbilt who specifically works on trauma theory. And she said, this is a classic reaction to a traumatic event that you can't really put into words, that you have to find other senses as a way of recreating what went on. Here's one called Symphony of Terror, which he shows gas masked German soldiers advancing past barbed wire while French soldiers are either dead or about to die. and tear gas, not tear gas, mustard gas is emitting into the sky. And he loved to do, we discovered that he loved to do barbed wire as a kind of calligraphy and filigree. And so many of his paintings, barbed wire is a horrible device of war, but it's also a beautiful. This is one of the most stunning images, Dance of Death, which is a medieval concept. You know, or if you've ever seen the movie The Seventh Seal, the Ingmar Bergman film, sort of the dead being led to hell in a kind of dance. And here these are three German soldiers that are dead or dying within barbed wire. But the barbed wire itself, look how beautiful it is. And go back to this. There's the barbed wire, but there are the cinders from the explosion. You know, so it's all the hell of war and the beauty of war and the beauty of vision has all worked together. Okay. This, I'll just talk about this image. It's called Runner Through a Barrage, His Arm Shattered, His Mind Gone. And I would say this is the first painting I've been able to identify a post-traumatic stress disorder, or you know, shell shock, as it was termed back then. But the man has lost his arm, and he has what the soldiers call the thousand-yard stare as he looks blankly ahead. And the forest itself has been devastated by the bombardment. And the trees, you see how each of the trees has a hand reaching out. It's very Disney. And I would say that this man, he's a fine artist, but he's also very much a part of a animation art that was just developing, comic book art. I think I consider him one of the first American comic book artists, even though he never did comic books. A couple other images of his. So it's very strong stuff. And this gentleman, this young man's leaving, so I think that's my hint that I'm about to end. And I keep teasing you saying about, but I will end. So what I want to say about Claggett Wilson, what happened to him? So after he came back from Maine, Kent came to New York, he had an exhibition of his work somewhere at a gallery in New York, got a lot of, looking on the record, there was a lot of praise for this work. And then it vanished. Nobody was interested. Nobody wanted to buy it. As again, I said, after the war, people wanted to forget the war. They didn't want these sort of horrific reminders of violence, however modernist or beautiful they might be. And so he continued painting other subjects, but nothing really caught on. So he moved into becoming a theater set designer. And so he hung out with sort of a Broadway crowd. And then he became an interior decorator, and that's what he did for the rest of his life. And he died in 1952 with complications from the respiratory illness he had gotten on the battlefield. So, and this is the thing I want to close with about Claggett Wilson. There's a website to Claggett Wilson. That was the only source of information I could get at first. And it was maintained by somebody named Claggett Wilson Reed. So I thought, well, Claggett Wilson Reed must be a descendant somehow. So I kept writing Claggett Wilson Reed, but he would never answer my letters. And then finally, I sort of got his phone number somehow. I was like a teleprompter, unidentified. Anyway, he talked to me, and he basically said, look, I have to go out right now. He didn't want to talk to me. He didn't know who I was. Well, then after our show opened, in almost every single review when it opened in Philadelphia, the New York Times gave it a fantastic review, Washington Post gave it a great review, and everybody singled out Claggett Wilson. He was considered the discovery of the show, the really important artist that nobody had heard of. And when Claggett Wilson Reed heard about this, learned about this, and I said, I was coming to New York for the opening of the show in New York, could we meet? And he wrote me this very apologetic letter, said, no, I really have business plans somewhere else. I can't be there. I'll see the show. And after that, this was just last summer, we started a correspondence. And he wrote me this handwritten 3-page letter that was just so beautiful, talking about how when he was a little boy, his Uncle Clagg was just like his hero. And it was his goal in life, said Claggett Wilson Reed, was to somehow maintain the legacy of Uncle Clagg. And that's why he started this website. And of course, he was overjoyed at all the attention that Uncle Clag's work is getting. So I'll end by recommending the National Gallery acquire some Claggett Wilson images. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.